Hello, gang, and welcome to another episode of National Bugle Radio. Today, we have back with us attorney Don Advo from Mexican-occupied California. Welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you, Patrick, and it's great to be here. It's great to speak to the National Bugle audience once again.
Well, it's great to have you again. And last time, which I believe was in August, we talked about Brown versus the Board of Education, which was very interesting because Brown versus the Board of Education is kind of held up as one of these great landmarks in the civil rights movement in America, overcoming its past and becoming a big, happy, multicultural family. And of course, you had a different take on it. And I definitely recommend people to go back because that is not a time-sensitive podcast. That is a classic. This is Don Advo's interpretation of the Brown versus the Board of Education as vesting the black race in property rights of white children. Did I restate it correctly? And you make a very persuasive case. Well, today we're going to follow on this, and I think this will be another timeless classic. So we're going to talk about the current slavery narrative of slavery was evidence of, I guess, some sort of evil that is inherent to the white race, and the amount of evil that was inflicted on the black race is so great that, I guess in the words of Martin Luther King, it can never be recompensated. And so in other words, we'll be repaying an unlimited debt for all of eternity. And you talk about it in terms of the establishment of a racial caste system. So I guess first we should talk about the institution of slavery itself, its history, and then we should probably move on to its repercussions to the modern day. Does that sound good?
I think that sounds very, very good.
Okay, so first what I want to ask you, because I know you've done a lot of research in this, is this institution of slavery. Obviously, we're not in any ways promoting slavery. It did terrible harm to most of the people involved and had massive negative repercussions throughout history. But what about the slavery narrative that we get and that our children get in public schools? What about it is misleading or false? Would you like to start from there?
Yeah, sure. Boy, what a fertile ground to talk about. Yeah, the narrative is that white people invented slavery, and not only that, that white people invented the slave trade, and you hear this kind of thing from people who really ought to know better. I heard some black intellectual talking about how the slave trade was invented by white people, actually trading in human beings as a commodity, and this was supposedly some great horrible thing separate and apart from, you know, enslaving your enemies or your neighbors or the people that you want a war against or whatever. And in a certain sense, it is. It is very different, but it was not invented by white European people. The slave trade, specifically the trade in Africans, did not start until the 1500s, approximately 500 years ago. And that trade was only made possible because white Europeans had mastered the shipbuilding and navigation skills that enabled them to build ships and sail the waters of the world and go pretty much anywhere they wanted to go.
So at that time, nobody else could have crossed the Atlantic Ocean but Europeans.
That's absolutely correct. I saw some book about how the Chinese did some around-the-world voyage in 1421, and I read the book. It was, in my view, it was not terribly credible. It showed the route that they took, and they went everywhere but Europe. I thought, how strange that they would avoid Europe. Mm-hmm. Of course, if they'd landed in Europe, that would have hit Europe like a thunderclap. We'd be reading about it. Mm-hmm. There would be all kinds of documentary history about the Chinese landing in Europe in 1421 or 22, whatever it was, because the Europeans certainly knew about China. The famous Marco Polo traveler, I think that was in the late 1300s.
That's right.
When Marco Polo made his famous voyage.
And Christopher Columbus was aware of Marco Polo.
Oh, absolutely. Columbus was on his way to China, and he would have gotten there if he hadn't bumped into the continents of Northern America and Southern America, not to mention the Caribbean islands.
Right. And I just want to add that both the Chinese and the Arabs were sailing in oceans, but they weren't really going deep water so much. They were sailing along the coast. You know, the Arabs were sailing down the coast of Africa. The Chinese had sailed, I guess, around the Indian Ocean coast to India and maybe to as far as Arabia. But they weren't crossing oceans. They were sailing along shores pretty much. That's my understanding.
Well, that's absolutely correct. The Arabs came as far north as Iceland. They were on slave capturing and slave trading expeditions to enslave and capture white European Christians so they could bring them back to the Middle East, the northern African countries where they could sell them in their slave trade. The African slave trade, that is the trade in African people, actually began in about the 8th century in the 700s, about 700-800 years before the transatlantic slave trade. The headquarters for the Arab slave trade was in Zanzibar, mm-hmm. on the eastern coast of Africa. And
what's now Tanzania. Tanzania is from Zanzibar, yeah. It's Tanganyika and Zanzibar put together was the invented country of Tanzania.
Throughout this entire period, hundreds of years before the transatlantic slave trade, as it was known, many, many millions of Africans were taken out of Africa. They were taken across land up into the Middle East, and they were shipped out of the seaport in Tanzania. And millions of them were sent to India. The Indian subcontinent was actually the recipient of many, many millions of...
Millions of
African black people. It was Zanzibar was the port, and of course they were shipped to Arabia and other parts of the world.
Now, if you say millions, this is really significant.
Generally accepted number is that about 11.5 million came across the Atlantic to the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, and how many to North America?
The mortality rate was about 10%, so say 10 million of them arrived here, give or take a few.
Okay. And then how about to North America? Is that 400,000?
Well, to the territory that became known as the United States, the number was about 5% of that, which was approximately 500,000.
All right.
I want to cover the Arab slave trade a little more before we get into the transatlantic slave trade. The Arab slave trade was humming, I mean really humming away. In 894... the 9th century, that's 894, not 1894, 894, like 1,100 years ago, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of slaves in what is today called Iraq. And you don't associate Iraq or any of these Middle Eastern countries with African slaves, but in that year, in 894, there was a huge slave uprising, a huge slave rebellion, and they achieved liberation, and they occupied a huge territory. And they did so for approximately 14 years, and then they were reconquered by their Muslim masters. Remember that Muhammad, the founder of the Muslim religion of Islam, lived in about the mid-600s, I think 648, 650, something like that. And slavery is fully recognized and fully legitimized by Islam. There's nothing in Islam that prohibits the enslavement of non-Muslims. Islam is one of those dual morality kind of religions where there's one set of rules for how you treat fellow practitioners, how you treat fellow Muslims, and another set of rules for how people, infidels, people outside, are treated. You can basically do anything to infidels you want, enslave them, rape them, murder them, kill them, dispossess them, whatever. But there are ethical constraints in what you can do to other Muslims, at least in theory. Well, in 894, they had a huge slave uprising, hundreds and hundreds of thousands. The Arab slave trade went on for 1,400 years. Now, we use a number of 11.5 million for the transatlantic slave trade. Conservatively speaking, the Arab slave trade took 140 million people out of Africa. That sounds like a huge number, but remember, it went on for 1,400 years. So if you divide 1,400 into 140 million, you get about 100,000 a year. Now, obviously, there were years where it was much more than that and years when it was much less than that. So it had its peaks and it had its valleys, but it was a huge number. And there's another factor about the Arab slave trade, and that is the level of brutality. The mortality rate in the transatlantic slave trade was about 10%, but in the Arab slave trade, it was from 75 to 90%. Mm-hmm. of the people died along the way. The men were routinely castrated, so they could not reproduce.
Which is why you don't have so much of an African signature in the populations of India or Arabia, I take it, then.
Absolutely true. Absolutely correct. But what this means is that for every 9 African slaves who arrived in the Western Hemisphere, 1 died on the way. For every 1 African slave that arrived in the Middle East, 8 to 9 Africans died along the way. And the transatlantic slave trade was primarily males. The Arab slave trade was more females than males, which should give you some indication of why they wanted them. It certainly wasn't for work, necessarily for work. It was for sexual gratification. And in any case, the numbers are pretty horrific. But 5% of the slaves that came to the Western Hemisphere ended up in the United States, ended up in what was called the United States. Now, effective in 1808, the international slave trade to the United States was completely outlawed. It was against the law to import African slaves.
And wasn't that, there had been a 20-year grace period put into the Constitution that was adopted in 1788, the Constitution
right.
was adopted?
That's correct. The international slave trade would be allowed to continue until 1808. But what is not generally known is that in 1793 or 94, one of the earliest pieces of legislation was a law prohibiting American participation in the international slave trade. There was a very, very strong law which provided an asset forfeiture provision for any American who was involved in the slave trade. And what that meant is if you were outfitting a ship or you were using a ship for the purposes of the slave trade, even outfitting a ship, if you had your ship in port and they were working to outfit it to be used in the slave trade, that ship could be confiscated by the government and the owners would forfeit all right, title, and interest in that ship.
And ships were amongst the most expensive things, the most valuable assets of the time, right?
Well, they were highly valuable. The loss of a ship was certainly a major loss. And if you read the federal court opinions of this era, there were many ships that were seized, and this was challenged in the courts. That's actually how I found out about it. I was going through an old federal practice digest under the subject of slavery, and I looked at a number of the cases that dealt with the issue of slavery, and I frankly had never heard of this law that went into effect. Even though we could still import slaves from Africa, they could not be imported by American slave traders or American ships, and any American who was involved in the international slave trade would be subject to criminal prosecution. In 1818, 10 years after outlawing the importation of African blacks, they actually made it a death penalty, a capital crime for Americans to be involved mm-hmm. in slavery. Now, that didn't completely stop it. From 1807 to the Civil War, approximately 278,000 Africans were smuggled into the United States illegally. Now,
278,000. So that would be
half a century. That's about 5,000 a year.
And if we're saying that it was about 500,000 or so who came to North America, this would potentially constitute the majority of the slaves
that
came.
Well, it's the 1790 census. There were 600,000 blacks in America,
many of whom had been born in America, as opposed to being brought.
Yeah,
in, right?
Overwhelmingly had been born in America. And the interesting thing is that in 1789, Haiti, well, the French Revolution occurred, and Haiti got caught up in the middle of the French Revolution, and officially slavery was abolished by the French Revolutionary government. That didn't go over very well in Haiti, and in addition to the kind of a revolution of fighting between Republican forces and royalty forces, there was all kinds of fighting over slavery. But in 1789, the year that tumultuous event occurred, Haiti had about 500,000 slaves, had approximately the same number of slaves as the United States, interestingly enough, although they were concentrated in a much smaller area. If you see Haiti, mm-hmm. it's a very small area.
About the size of Maryland.
Yeah, approximately. So that's a huge number of slaves to have in one place. And the population was about 500,000 slaves, blacks, 28,000 mulattoes, that is mixed-race people, and about 30,000 whites. Now, the figures that really I found quite astonishing with regard to Haitian slavery are the fact that of the 500,000 black slaves there, two-thirds were born in Africa, which means they were brought in during their lifetimes. They were not born there. And when you have two-thirds of a population born in Africa, what this means is you had a very, very high mortality rate of slaves. Because slaves were easily and cheaply imported into the island, they would simply be worked to death under very brutal and very harsh conditions. And then you didn't really need very many women because you didn't rely on the domestic production of slaves, mm-hmm. slave children being born and growing up and becoming old enough and big enough to work in the fields and do the heavy manual labor. In terms of different types of slavery, it was a very economically efficient form of slavery because you worked them as hard as you possibly could and simply replaced them with cheap imported slaves. Of those 500,000 slaves, 40%, hold on to your hat, 40% were owned by free blacks. That is an absolutely astonishing
And this
figure.
This is in Haiti. So there is a population of free blacks, and they were part of the ownership class of slaves. And
they were part of the ownership class. They owned 40% of the slaves, which is an astonishingly
And that, is that just the blacks, or is that the mulattoes also?
Probably mulattoes, too. Mm-hmm. It was free people of color. Mulattoes were people of color.
Right, all right.
The mulattoes were kind of a strange group. You had a three-tiered racial system, and the blacks and the mulattoes hated each other. And the mulattoes were regarded as light-skinned, and even within the black community, there was tremendous conflict and tremendous envy and resentment and jealousy and hatred by some blacks of lighter-skinned blacks. That's just the way it's always been.
And that's how it's been in the United States, probably today as well. But I know
it is that way today. They call it colorism.
Yeah, and
racism. So we have racism and genderism and sexism. There's also colorism.
Yeah.
Within the black community.
Yeah, and I know from a woman I know who had taught at an all-black school. She was white, but she taught at an all-black school, and the principal, who was light-skinned, had that attitude against the dark-skinned kids. He just thought that they were inferior. That they weren't as smart, they weren't going to learn as much, they were going to cause more trouble.
Slavery was ended, theoretically, in Haiti long before it was in the United States. The founder, of course, we hear a lot of talk about how the founders of America were slave owners, and this is a great black mark in history that totally delegitimizes white people in the United States. The principal founder of Haiti was a freed slave, an ex-slave named Toussaint Louverture, who was a very brilliant man, a great military leader. He was a French officer. He served the French Republic.
Was he black or mulatto?
Oh, he was black. He was very black. He was very black. He was an officer in the French Army. He fought the British and he fought the Spanish. There was a huge amount of global conflict in the Caribbean. It's kind of a lost chapter of world history. The British lost 25,000 soldiers in the American War for Independence, but they lost 100,000 people in the Caribbean. It was almost like their Vietnam. I mean, bear in mind, we only lost 55,000 in Vietnam, which is a huge number, but the British lost about 100,000 in the Caribbean, fighting the French, fighting the Spanish, and even sometimes fighting the Haitis. Well, Louverture was able to galvanize the black slaves in Haiti and form them into an efficient fighting force, and he defeated French, Spanish, and British armies, and he was able to proclaim independence. Toussaint Louverture was a former slave owner himself. He owned about 30 slaves. So even the founding father of Haiti was a slave owner. So prolific was the institution of slave ownership in that era. He wrote his own, they didn't have a constitutional convention. He sat down and wrote his own constitution, which made him president for life. Well, he ended slavery, but as the people in Haiti were later to find out, ending slavery is not necessarily the same thing as freeing slaves. He still imposed forced labor. He made people work. He was afraid blacks would fall back into their old habits of subsistence agriculture and doing just enough to get by. He realized that the plantations had to work and the economy had to work for Haiti to maintain its independence from Western powers. So he had a policy of forced labor, but he reduced the working day from 18 hours to 12 hours. And he did away with the torturing and the flogging and much of the brutality. And actually, the economy enjoyed a boom, and the island did very well under him. And ultimately, he was captured by the French and exiled, taken to France in prison, and he died. And then the country was taken over by a succession of bloodthirsty dictators, and they've probably had 40 or 50 constitutions. Nobody knows the exact number. In any event, 5% of the slaves that were brought to the Western Hemisphere came to the United States. By 1825, 20 years after the end of the slave trade into the United States, the number of blacks in the Western Hemisphere that lived in the United States was not 5%. In accordance with the number who originally brought here, it was 25%. It was one out of every four, which is an astonishingly high number. And the reason for that high number is that the standard of living and the treatment were very good. The standard of living was very high, and the blacks could sustain a very high birth rate, not just a replacement rate, but an expansion rate. The slave population in America grew from 600,000 in 1790 to about 4.5 million at the end of the Civil War. Let's talk about slavery being genocidal and mass murder and all this.
So at the end of the Civil War, in other words, if there had been 400,000 or 500,000 slaves brought to the United States from Africa over 200 plus years, and then at the end of the slavery period, you have 4.5 million, that's a tenfold increase.
Right. And the 278,000 that were brought in over a half a century, that really that doesn't amount to much. I mean, if you average it out, it's about 5,500 a year. That's 1%. That's 1% of the slave population in 1800. And of course, as the slave population grew, it would have been statistically insignificant. The explosion of the black population existed because of the humane treatment of black people and because of a very, very high birth rate.
Mm-hmm.
Very high birth rate.
Okay.
And then, of course, the blacks have continued to multiply. They have held pretty steadily as a percentage of the United States population at about 13%.
And that is without immigration, without black immigration. Whereas the white population, if you're thinking of post-1865, you have 50 years worth of Ellis Island, where you had massive European immigration, and the black population still kept up with the white population through that period. And now in this new era, the past 50 years of mass immigration, if you go back to 1965, the black population was about 11% of the country. Now it's up to about 13% of the country, despite the importation of what's become 50 or 60 million Hispanics, if not more.
Absolutely correct. The threat to black demography is not white racists. It's the incoming Asians and the incoming Hispanics who are virulently racist against black people and really have no use for them.
Right. And now before we move on to the modern era, I know that you had also looked into internal migration of blacks and states like Mississippi putting up bans on the importation of blacks from other parts of the country like Virginia. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. In the early 1800s, most of the northern states had abolished slavery. People talk about slavery as being rooted in states' rights. Slavery existed long before there were states. It's been part of the human condition, you know, since forever. It was the states' rights, the federal system that we have in this country, that permitted states on a state-by-state basis actually to abolish slavery piecemeal and gradually build up an anti-slave state bloc in the northern states. And there were all sorts of reasons for it, but even by the 1830s, the slaves were starting to flow out of Virginia. Slavery worked at its best when you have virgin land, virgin fertile land in a fertile area. It works best with cash crops like tobacco, like sugarcane, like cotton, ultimately cotton. But once the land becomes exhausted, slavery does not work very well when you have to reconstitute land. Notice something very interesting about African slaves. They were never brought into the continent of Europe or the British Isles. You did not see slaves brought into work the farms in those countries at all because there was no virgin land. The cash crop cycle did not exist in those lands. Of course, they were not tropical either, so you didn't need to import a workforce that was more acclimated to a tropical environment. But Virginia was sending its slaves south. They were moving toward the new states where there was lots of virgin land and lots of open territory, and they were moving away from the northern slave states. Well, something very interesting happened in 1830. There was a slave uprising in Southampton County in Virginia, mm-hmm. and this kind of went through the South like a thunderclap. The South was always very, very, very schizophrenic about the issue of slavery. They talked about the happy, contented slaves. Yeah, they lived in terror and fear of slave uprisings and being killed by the slaves. They were very, very aware and very mindful of the slave uprising in Haiti. And in the aftermath of all of that, the white people in the island were basically exterminated in a huge uprising. It's a very controversial event. There are actually a number of uprisings, a number of massacres, some of which were instigated by European powers. In one instance, the Spanish talked some Haitians into luring a bunch of white people into a church, and then they locked the doors and killed all the white people inside. And then there's some indication that the great massacre of all the white people on the island was actually done at the instigation of a British agent who said, if you get rid of all the white people, most of whom were French, of course the French and the British were traditional enemies, and they continued to be so. This is kind of like the Napoleonic period. And so there is some evidence that there was some British skullduggery involved in the extermination of the white French population. And there was a deal made that if they would exterminate their white French, they would get recognition and support from the British. I haven't really followed up on that, but it makes a lot of sense. And it was typical of the kind of things that European powers did even to each other during that era. But the people in the South were very, very much aware of the massacres in Haiti. And then you have this slave uprising in Virginia. You know, they went on a rampage and wiped out a couple of white families, a couple of white farms. And in many of the southern states, if not all of them, there was a huge, huge awareness of this. In the state of Mississippi, in 1832, they drew up a new constitution. And this constitution said that effective 1833, the following year, it would be illegal to bring slaves into the state of Mississippi for the purpose of being sold as merchandise, mm-hmm. which meant professionally you could not bring in slaves for purpose of selling them. You could only bring in your own slaves for your own personal usage, and that importation would be illegal effective 1845.
Mm-hmm. These legal changes, they weren't just proposed, but they went into effect.
No, the Mississippi State Constitution, this is not a statute, this is actually the Constitution.
And
certainly
so,
could go into effect. It was challenged in the courts, and in 1841, the United States Supreme Court, in the case of Groves versus Slaughter, said yes, it was constitutional.
And so in 1845, then, Mississippi banned the importation of slaves.
Completely,
from,
that's correct.
From
yeah.
other parts of the United States, not just internationally, but from other parts of the United States.
Anywhere you couldn't bring them into the state. Mm-hmm. And similar laws were passed in Louisiana, Missouri, Kentucky, Arkansas, and Alabama. And this was an interesting thing. I read the Supreme Court opinion, Groves versus Slaughter, and if you just type that in, it was an 1841 opinion. Google it, you can find it and read it. In a separate section, they had the argument of counsel. And I had found this opinion before and read it, and I was aware of the legal arguments, but I wasn't aware of the history of it, what brought it about. And then the legal argument to the court, the lawyer for the state of Mississippi pointed out the reason for it. See, there was a challenge to it on a number of grounds, one of which was the grounds that the federal government had exclusive regulation over interstate commerce, that a state couldn't say, we're going to ban products coming in. See, California can't pass a law that says we're going to ban oranges from the state of Florida. And that was the argument that was made. There was a huge amount of opposition to this law. And the Supreme Court said, you know, sorry, they can do it because it's an exercise of the state police power for public safety. It's not really an economic mm-hmm. thing. They're not trying to protect their local slave industry. It's not really commerce in that sense. California can keep out Florida oranges if they're diseased or if they're protecting
their
safety.
Or if they're violent.
if they're violent. So this was 1841. This was 9 years after the Constitution of 1833 was passed.
Okay.
And in the justification for this constitutional provisions, the lawyer of the state of Mississippi talked about the slave uprising in 1830 in Southampton County in Virginia and said, you know, we took stock of the slave population of the state of Mississippi. In some counties, it was 10-1 blacks over mm-hmm. whites.
So I have,
and we concluded this just the presence of so many slaves was a threat to the public safety.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, the problem was not that they couldn't get enough slaves. I mean, this is, you know, half a century almost after the slave trade has stopped.
Yeah.
The problem is not that they couldn't get enough slaves. The problem is that they had too damn many.
They had too many. They had too many. So I have a question. And
sure.
I used to teach courses on American history, on the American presidency. And in particular, I'm thinking of one president, James K. Polk. And during his administration, you had both the Mexican-American War, which was 1845 to 1848, I believe, and the annexation of the northwestern part of the United States. You know, there had been the 54-40 or fight, how much of the North, the Pacific Northwest would be annexed. And there was a compromise with Britain, and they annexed up to, I believe, the 49th parallel. But the debate over this territorial expansion, as I recall, and I'd like your confirmation, the southern states, or the southern elite, should I say, was in favor of the Mexican War because they needed space to expand slavery. And, you know, when I was teaching it, it wasn't clear to me exactly why they would want to expand slavery, but it seems to me now that the Southeast was becoming overpopulated with slaves, that if you had annexation of the Northwest, you would have the poor landless white population moving to the Northwest to homestead, further tipping the demographic balance towards slaves and towards slave revolts. And so they needed a place to remove their excess slaves too. And given that you were just saying that state after state was banning the importation of slaves, where could they move them to except Western territories, Southwestern territories? Is that a correct interpretation?
I think it is a correct interpretation. One of the big grievances of Jefferson Davis and other members of the Confederacy is that they could not take their slaves into the Western Territory. There was tremendous opposition to the spread of slavery. Remember, the Republican Party was founded to oppose the spread of slavery. sentimentally and temperamentally, they were opposed to slavery, but they accepted its right to exist in those states where it already existed. But they were virulently opposed to the spread of slavery. White people were universally, in the North, were universally opposed to that. Lincoln said he wanted the Great Plains and the Great Western Territories to be the exclusive province of white working people. But yes, they needed to expand it. Agricultural conditions. They were running out of fresh, virgin, fertile land. And once they exhausted the land, the typical pattern was to move on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they figured they could move out to the West and use slaves in mining and in other ventures. But slavery really contained the seeds of its own destruction. Because, you know, remember we talked about Haiti, and you could have a pretty much all-male slave population because you just imported new slaves. Mm-hmm. But when you can't import new slaves, you have to grow your own slaves. That means you have to have a female population. Mm-hmm. They have to be supported and cared for. And that and they worked. I mean, the women didn't just sit around. They had to work, too. But you had to have children, and they really couldn't do much work until they were, you know, 13 or 14 years old. And they weren't fully grown until they were 18 or 19. So you had to have a population of women, and you had to have these young slaves. And not all the infants were going to be black workers. They were going to be women. So American slavery was becoming increasingly untenable in the mm-hmm. modern world. You had a drift toward mechanized agriculture, which would pretty much make slavery obsolete. And the threat to the physical safety of the white people to have so many blacks around. Mm-hmm. And I was stunned to see that they took notice of this in 1830. And in Mississippi, they completely redid the state constitution. It certainly wasn't out of kindness or benevolence that they wanted to choke off the domestic, it was called the domestic slave trade. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're quite right. They wanted to expand into the Western territory. Slavery was always looking to expand. They wanted to expand into the Caribbean. There was a slave plot to take over Cuba. Mm-hmm. They were called filibusterers, and they mm-hmm. would go, there was, I guess, a filibuster army that went into Nicaragua when they tried to conquer that for slavery. But the tide of history was really going in the other direction. Slavery was really on the way out, even in the 1830s. And I was pretty surprised to read this opinion.
So on the way out, and the fact that banning the slave trade is almost universally, isn't it a step towards banning slavery in general? And state after state had already banned the slave trade, not just internationally, but the domestic slave trade.
Yeah, the domestic slave trade. Yeah, if you can't trade slaves, that's really a huge, huge step in the direction of ending the institution. Mm-hmm. Because you end up with a huge population, only maybe half of them can actually go out and do work. So you've got to support the other half, which are women and children. And increasingly, the type of agriculture is simply not suited mm-hmm. to slave labor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to now move to the impact of slavery on the modern era. So when the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment were passed at the end of the Civil War, the slave population in the United States was somewhere, 4.5 million, right?
Correct.
About 10 times greater than the number of slaves who had been imported to the United States, Right. But only about 1/10 the number of blacks we have now. And so when you think about it, from 400,000 to 500,000 blacks who were brought from Africa into the United States over those couple of centuries where you had the importation of slaves, from that seed, you have now over 40 million black Americans. Now, the black Americans, there's been a certain admixture of European genes, at least 20%. So you could look at the black American race as being really created in the United States, not just brought over from Africa, but kind of being created in the United States. And you can also look at how many other populations would you find that went from a few hundred thousand a few centuries ago and are now 40 million? How many have had this 80 to 100-fold increase in just three or so centuries? Because the population of the world around 1800 was a billion. Now it's, 7 billion? So that's a 7-fold increase. The population of the world during this period of time, maybe it's increased by 10-fold, but the black population, this race that I'm saying was basically created in the United States, has had a 100-fold increase. So demographically, in spite of slavery, in spite of Jim Crow, in spite of anything else, white racism has been one of the most successful groups of people around the world demographically in terms of their reproduction. And then if you look at their current standard of living and you look around the world, they're very successful. I mean, they've got the cell phones, they live in nice warm houses, they don't have to fear starvation, they don't have to fear cold, they drive around in cars. And so economically, very successful. And of course, it's a success that certainly in our lifetimes has been heavily subsidized. You think of the subsidies in the terms of public schools, having their public school education subsidized by white taxpayers. You know, their reproduction, their health care. You know, you look at Obamacare even just the past few years, you can look at that as a transfer of resources from a primarily white tax base to a largely black recipient base. Yet, in spite of all that, the narrative out there has been one of historical injustice, and I'm not trying to justify slavery, but continuing injustice, economic exploitation, that's the narrative. And before I hand it over to you, I just want to bring up, in the 1980s, I spent a lot of time in South Korea, and I would see people who were working 12-hour a day, at least 6 days a week. So you're talking about 72-hour work weeks, very common. I'd see these people working very, very hard. And I went to Guam a few years back, and Guam has become largely a playground for Koreans. And I see a lot of young Koreans and middle-aged Koreans, and I'm happy that they're successful now. And I always thought, I wish I was seeing more of the old Koreans because they worked so hard to make it happen. But at any rate, you have, whether you're talking about the Koreans of the 1980s or you're talking about maybe the Russians of the middle of the 20th century or other groups, the English of the 1800s, who worked, who sacrificed maybe in industrial jobs, and they sacrificed, and the fruits of their sacrifice are enjoyed by later generations. And yet here you have the black population and the slaves, to the extent they were worked hard, that's a huge sacrifice. And did they get to enjoy the fruits of their sacrifice? Not necessarily personally, but they were able to reproduce, and their progeny are enjoying great benefits from their sacrifice. And my final statement would be, where else would you see an agricultural workforce historically that has been rewarded, at least to its posterity, has been rewarded the same way that the African American slaves were? Rewarded, well, in posterity.
I'm not specifically aware of any. They shared in the great miracle that is America. We went from a colonial power, 13 struggling colonies that could easily have been stamped out by jealous European powers. And through some miracle, we made it through. We became a great colossus. We became a country which every other people in the world want to come for a better life. And you can't escape the fact that after emancipation, there was no move of blacks to leave and go back to their ancestral homeland. There were no blacks who wanted to go to Haiti for a better life. Quite the contrary. After slavery was officially ended in Haiti, thousands of free Haitians came to the United States, to Louisiana, to the southern states where slavery was still legal after slavery was officially abolished in Haiti, because the quality of life under a white government was so much better. And that continues today. Blacks don't go to Haiti, Mexicans don't go to Mexico, and Asians don't go to Asia for a better life. They come to the white United States, and once they get here, they want to live in a white neighborhood and go to white schools. There was a racial conflict here. It's a racial conflict. I think the races are natural enemies, and they exist best when they exist on different continents with oceans between them and with strong borders and border walls between them. I think that is the lesson to be learned. But the point is that insofar as all this talk about genocide and slavery is the worst crime that ever happened in the history, and I've heard blacks say this is the worst crime in the history of the world. Well, if it's a horrible crime, your numbers don't increase tenfold or a hundredfold. They don't increase at all. They diminish. I mean, in Haiti, they had a negative birth rate. Mm-hmm. And once they cut off the slaves, the importation of slaves from Africa, they would either have had to do completely away with slavery or change their treatment of slaves so that they could have reproduced. So when you cut off the international slave trade in the United States, people kind of yawn, oh, okay, they cut off the slave trade. That was a huge thing. That was an absolutely huge, huge thing. to do that. And this law that was passed that prohibited whites...
So when you're talking about cutting off the international slave trade... Excuse me. When you're talking about cutting off the international slave trade, are you talking specifically about the United States Constitution shutting it down?
Yes.
And then,
yes.
Of course, you could add to that then the British Empire using its navy to stop the transatlantic slave trade as well.
Right, right. Yeah, the British were a very powerful factor in that. And absolutely. The cutting off of the slave trade was a huge, huge step in ending slavery. It immediately resulted in the better treatment of slaves.
Mm.
Because, you know, if they all died off, what were you going to do then? You know, if you flogged them all to death or worked them all to death with 18-hour days and malnutrition, you simply wouldn't have any slaves left. And I hear all this talk about how brutal they were. They were flogged 3 times a day and twice on Sunday and all this. It's not possible for a population that is brutalized that way to have a birth rate that will expand. And we know this from Haiti. Haiti had a negative birth rate. Mm-hmm. And Haiti, people were flogged pretty brutally. They were tortured in all sorts of ways. It was a very, very horrible place. Unfortunately, it didn't get much better after emancipation and after they got their independence, given the terrible condition of that country and the fact that people want to run away from it to the United States and live next door to white racists so they can have a better life. You see, the white supremacy argument, it begs the question, we're not superior. Why does everybody want to come and live next door to us and go to our schools? You know, that's an easy way to shut them down. And just say, well, fine, why do you want to live in my neighborhood? Why do you want to go to school with my kids? Why do you feel that you have a constitutional right to force captive, unwilling white children into a classroom with you if we are so dangerous and so racist and so violent? And you have to confront these people. And I've done this. I've done it in person. I've done it online. And they just go crazy. It's like their heads explode.
Mm-hmm.
And they start ranting and raving and racist. And there's something wrong with a lot of these people, with the way they process information. There's just something strange about it.
So, okay.
So I don't know how to diagnose it or even if it can be diagnosed, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's observed. You can't miss it.
Yeah. So we're coming up towards the end of the show, but one thing I want to ask is, okay, given we have this, well, we've got this large white population of 200 million or so in the United States that's born here, that's roots go way back, and we have this black population of 40 million or so that's also has roots that go way back, and getting an ocean of separation between us is not an immediate prospect, to say the least. To what extent do you think there can be any improvement, at least by gaining control of the narrative, of overthrowing this narrative that blacks have been continually suffering nonstop for 300 or 400 years, to one where certainly the demographic and economic benefits that the modern African-American population enjoys due to the enslavement of its ancestors of several generations ago, and also that the hardships of their ancestors several generations ago probably wasn't that unusual for that era, that probably populations around the world, whether they were enslaved, whether they were serfs, whether they were free labor, that probably most people around the world during those 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, often the best they could hope for was to reproduce, and they couldn't hope for much more. Is there anything to be gained from that in terms of maybe reducing the chip on the shoulder of people and, you know, all of the ramifications, the crime, the resentment, the hatred, the anti-white hatred that stems from this chip that's been being placed on their shoulder? Is there any hope for that?
I don't think there's any hope that you're going to change the minds of the people who hate us and want us dead. My theory of white advocacy is that you're not going to win debates with the people who want us dead. What you're going to do is give white people the tools and the morale and the sense of worth that they need to fight for themselves.
So changing the narrative, even if it doesn't change the minds of blacks, for instance.
Will change the minds of whites.
If it changes the minds of whites.
I'm fighting for the minds of white people. Okay. I'm willing to concede the minds of blacks. Forget that. But I want to try and win the hearts and the minds of white people. It's white people who have been stripped of any sense of self-worth or any sense of the sense that we have the moral high ground. And when people believe they have the moral low ground, they will not fight. They will not fight to defend that of which they are ashamed. And even their own lives. You see this tremendous white self-hatred and white surrender and white resolve. And I remember the first broadcast I ever did on this whole issue. I said, the obstacle we have is not our enemies. The obstacle we have is the indifference of our own people.
Mm-hmm.
To secure our existence and a future for white people. White advocacy is not, it is to galvanize and organize white people. It is not to win debates with people who hate us. You're never going to win a debate with the Jews or with the blacks or the Mexicans.
Okay.
You know, they're not even capable of functioning cognitively on that level. But you're going to win a debate with your own people. And if you could give your own people a narrative that will give them back the optimism and the morale and the sense that they have the moral right to fight. See, that's the reason they stole our history. That's the reason they distorted our history, to weaponize it and destroy our will to fight. I mean, you know, white people invented ships that sailed around the oceans and now spaceships that go into outer space.
Mm-hmm.
You think people who couldn't figure out the wheel and who have problems with indoor plumbing are going to overwhelm us unless they sap our will and destroy us from the inside? They would never have a chance. They would never have a chance to beat us. That goes for the Mexicans and even the Asians that are you know, quite a bit higher. They can only destroy us by reason of our sanctioning them the right to do so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap this up?
Just thanks for having me on, and I hope I made a contribution. I hope I helped some white people achieve a level of moral clarity and give you some good arguments that you can use in the fight to save your fellow white people.
Well, thank you very much, Don Advo, for coming on, and I look forward to another discussion with you about another important issue sometime soon.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.